Welcome to High Noon, where we talk about controversial subjects with interesting people. And this week, I have somebody I've known for a very long time, off and on through Twitter, and then also just like gatherings and being on her radio show. And she's just everywhere. Kira Davis, and you can find her on Twitter at Real Kira Davis. And she also hosts her own podcast, which is called Just Listen to Yourself, which I feel like is very much your vibe. You have kind of that sassy vibe. If I'm not mistaken, you also ran for school board, didn't you?
I did. I ran for my school board in 2022 here in Orange County, California, and I lost.
It's a tough beat. I know a lot of folks in that position. But I mean, it takes so much to actually run for office and put yourself in the arena. I'm really sort of proud to know everybody who has attempted to do that. I think it's like one of the most valuable things that people in our little blah 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 talking space can do.
Well, thank you. It was definitely a learning experience. And to be honest with you, it's kind of still going on. It was a special election. So that seat is up for election this November as well. And so all of the politics that were in play 2 years ago are still in play today. And it was just, it's kind of crazy. Like, I expected a lot of pushback from progressives and the left, but I had to wade through the Republican Party too. And that was its own eye-opening experience in itself.
Yeah, and we're going to discuss the Republican Party, I think, with the retirement of Mitch McConnell and what that means for the Republican Party. But before we get to that, I mean, I've had some experiences with the California Republican Party as well. It especially in a state where they're losing so aggressively over and over again and are not even able to hold the line on anything. It's funny, like the party infrastructure is definitely coveted by a select group of people who really care about being on top of this little molehill, but who have like their lives don't really change.
Basically, yes.
They keep losing, which is in some ways, I think, the story of the Republican Party. But I wanted to get your thoughts on this monumental retirement of Mitch McConnell. You know, he's obviously has had quite a long legacy in the Republican Party. He's sort of the face of the establishment of the Republican Party, many times thwarting the base of the Republican Party. About a year ago, they did some fresh polling on approval and disapproval for Mitch McConnell. He had 60% disapproval rating and a single digit 6% approval rating. He's also the only Republican in any position of leadership in the Republican Party who is underwater with his own party in terms of popularity. That being said, obviously had some great victories in terms of shaping the judiciary, both the Supreme Court and the lower court level. You know, what's your sense of, one, what his legacy has been in the Republican Party, and two, what his retirement means or possibly means about the future of the Republican Party and how it might change?
Well, I think Mitch McConnell, this is definitely a changing of the guard. Well, I'll say that. And as a grassroots, you know, conservative Republican, there's a lot about Mitch McConnell that I don't like and especially haven't liked over the last few years. And I think there are a lot of people like me who are happy to see him go, but I'm actually not happy to see him go. I think he's done his job well over the years, and it's a thankless position. And I know that a lot of people want an activist in that position, but I think those people don't really understand how our government works and what that position is. And really, he's got to be a guy that can whip votes. And that's somebody who knows how to reach across the aisle when he has to, how to cut deals. He's got to know where all the bodies are buried. You know, he's got to have experience with the establishment and with the conservative base. Mitch McConnell is old. So he has all of that. He's got a lot of experience. And he really has guided the Senate through some really rough times. And I think what we will miss the most and what we really have to, or we, the Republican Party, has to think about carefully as they move forward with leadership is really that establishment bona fides that he has, to use a turn of phrase. But he's establishment And that means he does know how to get some things done. You need those people in the party. I despise that piece of politics, but I'm not naive enough to believe that those people don't play a part. So moving forward, they're really going to need somebody with a strong hand, somebody who's, again, who knows where the bodies are buried, because the Republicans have a tendency to split along ideological lines very often. And the fact that Mitch McConnell has managed on so many occasions to unite the Senate Republicans when it counts, I think it says something about his legacy. I think it's time for him to go. It's clear he's not in good health and he's old, and we really could use some young blood. But I don't want to say it's a happy day for the Republican Party. I don't think that.
Well, I think whether or not it's a happy day is probably very dependent on who his successor is. I maybe have a slightly agreeing and slightly disagreeing take from yours. I think Mitch McConnell was a formidable opponent to anything he wanted to oppose. You definitely wanted him on your team, and mm-hmm. he was an excellent parliamentarian. And when he wanted to get something done, he absolutely could. And that is, as you say, a very necessary part of the position. I would say the problem with Mitch McConnell is that what he wanted to get done was so at odds with what the voters that put Republicans into power wanted in terms of mm-hmm. priorities, that you can't really be in that position of leadership in the party when you are so at odds with the base of the party and the people who are voting for you. And you see how well he performed when his goals were aligned, right, with the base of the party. And everyone always points to the judges, right, and his legacy there. He was, I don't think anybody could say that Mitch McConnell wasn't capable. He was very competent and very capable. And I think you're right. We will miss those qualities. We will miss him as a parliamentarian. We will miss him as a guy who knows how to like twist arms and whip votes. But the problem is he was so often doing that against his own base. And what I found really unforgivable, especially in two waves of sort of populist correction in the Republican Party, first being the Tea Party, and the second being the Trump MAGA waves, which are different in all kinds of ways. And maybe we can talk about it, but his response to both was the same, was like overt hostility. Mm-hmm. And there were several decisions that he made that made it pretty clear to me that as the leader of the party, right, in the Senate, that he would rather have fewer people with R's next to their names sitting in Senate seats than more people who disagree with him. And that's fine if he's a senator and he like doesn't like a wing of the party. That's perfectly fine. And he's, you know, and that's for the voters of Kentucky to essentially decide. But I think if you take on that kind of party leadership role, having that kind of contempt for your own base and for their priorities as at best fodder for fundraising emails and not as serious legislative goals is disqualifying. And that's why I'm glad to see him go, although I do share your trepidation. I mean, some mm-hmm. of these names that have been thrown out, so John Thune, John Cornyn, these are clearly like establishment figures who would be heirs to McConnell. And I honestly, I don't know what either one of their parliamentarian skills looks like, but I can't imagine they'll be as good as McConnell, and they don't seem ideologically really more aligned with the party. So that seems like sort of a lose-lose situation to me, but you know, I don't know what their skills are like. And then the other names that are thrown out there, Rick Scott is supposedly the conservative alternative. I'm not sure how much I buy that. And then the dark horse candidate I've heard some people say is Tom Cotton, who I'd really love to see mm-hmm. step mm-hmm. in. I've heard some people say Marco Rubio as well. I mean, what's your sense on, I'm not going to ask you to opine like who's most likely. I don't think any of us know, but you know, what it'll mean if these different factions, like what would these different factions or any of these men taking Mitch McConnell's place say to you about the future of the Republican Party?
That's a good question. I think if we go, you know, establishment route, then it'll just say, you know, business as usual for the Republican Party. I'm curious, though, what it'll signal for Trump moving forward, or what it'll signal as it speaks to Trump, whether the party believes he's going to be the president again or not, and what kind of person he wants to work with. I don't think that I'm knowledgeable about all of these candidates to make any kind of intelligent assessment. But I will say this, again, I am a grassroots, like hard right conservative. I ran for school board, you know, but I understand the importance of having somebody who knows how the machine works. And I always look for people in those higher leadership positions who are going to split the difference, at least for me. I mean, I don't know what Tom Cotton's, I mean, he's a great conservative, but I don't know what Tom Cotton's, like, can he walk into someone's office and twist an arm and get the vote he needs? Do you know what I mean? He might be a nice guy, but is he a scary guy? That's what you need. I've always liked Rubio because he does split that difference for me. Came in on the Tea Party wave, so he's got those conservative sort of undertones, but he's like fairly establishment as well. So he knows where to press the flesh and, you know, kiss the butts. So I have no idea. Honestly, I'm just along for the ride at this point. It'll be interesting. But again, my concern moving forward is just, would we have a leader who can work with the possibility of a Trump presidency?
Yeah, I heard in this context of the establishment versus sort of the Trump, or, I mean, frankly, even like, how would you characterize somebody like Ted Cruz, right? Is he MAGA Republican? I mean, he ran against Trump and his endorsement was, you know, very late and very, let's say, humiliating. Like, how would you characterize some of these people? But, you know, if you think about Lee or Cruz or Cotton or Rubio or, you know, J.D. Vance, right? They actually represent quite a spread of ideological positions within the right. But what they all are is anti-establishment. I would like to see, I understand that caucus that let's say vaguely just covering over all of the intellectual diversity I just brought out, let's just call them the MAGA caucus, okay, whatever, right? Those folks, I understand those folks don't have a majority. I understand that Republicans don't have a majority, but like, even if they do, that part of the Republican Party is not a majority. But they do need more moderate voices. They need people like Murkowski, right? They need the moderate flank and the establishment flank of the Republican Party. What I have felt in the past, and maybe we're avoiding with the new speaker Johnson, but especially with John Boehner and all of these fights, these kind of like anti-establishment versus establishment fights, is we needed somebody who will not be actively contemptuous of the wing of the party that actually represents the base. And that has been a killer to me. Like it's, I don't expect to win every battle. Like I think people are realistic more than a lot of people in DC give Americans credit for being realistic. Like they understand that 49 is not 60. Like they understand that. They understand that there are limits to what Republicans can do, given any like amount of numbers or how many fellow Republicans they have. But I think fundamentally they didn't trust a lot of their leadership to get the best deal that they could. And that trust was broken, I think, for very good reason over decades of really clear.
Well, let me ask you this. Who is an example of somebody, maybe not necessarily who's in line for this position, but somebody in the Republican Party, a leader with influence that's not Trump, that is, doesn't despise the base, but respects the establishment?
I think Rubio is a good example of somebody who is in the middle like that, but you never know. Actually, sometimes it has nothing to do with where they are ideologically. Right. So like, I think Boehner was a really terrible speaker. He was a pretty conservative congressman. Like his voting record before he became speaker was on the conservative side of the caucus. But as speaker, he was weak. And he folded a lot of the times that he had a strong hand, and he repeatedly refused to listen to large parts of his caucus. I'm actually not super ideological. Like I don't need somebody in leadership with whom I agree on a bunch of substantive issues, as long as I feel like those substantive issues will be pushed as a matter of being part of the platform of the Republican Party and being conservative when there's an opportunity to do so. And so it's more about the judgment of the person. And I think you're right. Like, I don't know who that is in the Republican Party, but I'm certainly willing to give somebody else a shot at doing it, because I don't think McConnell did that very well. And again, the evidence is how many conservative priorities would die even when Republicans had a majority, versus when McConnell wanted to get something done, like funding for Ukraine. This latest round, obviously he's losing his grip. He lost both on the border bill fight and on by not knowing his own caucus. On the border bill, so-called border bill, and on Ukraine funding, but up until the last couple battles, he's always, you know, when he wanted to get something done, he could get it done. And I think there was a real feeling, an accurate feeling among conservatives, that he just doesn't really want to get it done for a lot of the issues that we care about as sort of base grassroots conservatives.
It's really interesting that we're having this conversation, because I can loop this back around to how we started when you asked me about the school board race. And it's the same thing locally. Like, we're just experiencing the same thing. And what it is it's the old guard versus the people who live real life. As a matter of fact, I was talking to my campaign manager the other day, and we were just sort of gossiping about what's going on in this current race. And, she said exactly what you said. She said, these people don't have to live our lives. They don't have to, they can play games at their country club luncheons, and they can go to their fundraisers and take their pictures. But no matter what happens in these elections, they all go back to their mansions. They all go back behind their gates. Their money isn't affected. Their lives aren't affected. So when I was needing help from the Republican Party to combat these unions, we were trying to flip our school board. And it's the second largest school board. It's the second largest school district in the state. So it's a really big deal. The Republicans were nowhere to be found, or they worried because of my media presence. They weren't very helpful because I made them nervous because I was too conservative and on Fox News all the time and saying things that could get them in trouble. And that is the attitude of the leadership, even in local GOP and state GOP here in California, but as we're talking, the national GOP as well, which is these older people who believe that, who are stuck in 1960, 1970, and they believe that that is still the landscape, that for the most part, people are Democrat or they're Republican, but we all kind of have the same goals. And the point is, it's just keep the country running. And they don't have any idea how freaking crazy it is out here. It's like mass chaos. Everything is upside down. Crime everywhere. Your kids are learning about masturbation in kindergarten. Like, it's absolute insanity. Everyone's running around with their hair on fire, but the leadership is at the top, you know, sitting next to Marie Antoinette saying, let them eat cake. And that really is the crux of every issue we talk about, including who's going to lead the Republican Senate.
Yeah, there's no issue on which that's clearer, I think, than immigration, by the way. And yeah, no, that really is, that there is a kind of copacetic attitude towards whether people win or lose in DC. They've seen the guard change so many times. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think my friend and guest on here a few times, Rachel Bovard, said it best, which is the Republican establishment views power as a trophy to be put on a shelf and polished. And actually, like, the act of winning an election, of winning that power, is the end goal in itself. It's not mm-hmm. to use that political capital and that political power. They're just glad to be back in the power seat and to do all of the things behind the scenes that they like to do in Washington, D.C. But there really isn't actually a purpose behind it beyond just winning that trophy and putting it on their shelf for that 4 years or whatever it is. And it really is this mentality that doesn't get into how different, I mean, think about how different the lives, even like, forget about the border states who have been dealing with this forever, but like, even in blue New York City, right? We have these migrants streaming in to the city that are actually blocking resources for city residents. They've taken over the park near me, right? Like, this is one tenth of what the border states have been experiencing for years. And that's just that kind of urgency does not penetrate in Washington, D.C. whatsoever, which is why I'm always a little bit, I like it. I like the fact that we had 80 votes for speaker. Mm-hmm. I was not worried about the quote unquote chaos. I think it's good when that bursts forward into the way that Washington, D.C. operates, because those are the moments that our politics are not totally orthogonal, totally separated from the feeling of living out the effects of the direction, both like the policies that have been implemented, but also like the general direction and cultural zeitgeist of the country right now. I like it when that chaos spills into Washington, D.C. I want to rattle them a little bit, because there is that sense that they're all playing a game and they're all friends.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that. I said the exact same thing when all that was going on. I was like, because, there were so many whiners out there on social media, like, we need to come together. All this fighting isn't going to help any. And it's just going to end up this way or that way anyway. You know that. But it's like, why shouldn't we fight? Why shouldn't we fight? We're fighting out here in the streets. We're fighting for these daily resources. We're fighting these daily issues. And that's exactly what we send our representatives to do in Washington, D.C. So no, why in the hell would we just sort of hand something over to somebody that we think inherited it? That's the whole problem. That's how we're in this mess. So I want to see the party duking it out. And, and the upside and the downside of that is that somebody wins and somebody loses. But that's how it should be. And it's somebody wins and then you have another fight, another battle, and then somebody else wins. But I was doing a talk with a local Republican Women's Federation, like at a luncheon. And one of the women said, we're fighting here in our area. We're fighting these school board battles, really. And we can't get the establishment part of our party to pay attention to what's going on here, even though it's having like larger effects on polling for other races like city council. And so it's really important. So we're battling them and we feel like we're in this constant battle. How do we settle this and come together so that we can actually get some stuff done and actually win around here? And I was like, I don't think you're going to come together. Somebody has to win. So I think the only way to end this for now is to win. That's unfortunate because it means you can also lose, but that we have to have these fights so somebody can win. And then we move forward until we have another battle. But this whole idea of, oh, we come together and lock arms and sing Kumbaya just because we all vote, for that same letter on the ballot, that's ridiculous. It's not at all what our founding fathers went through. I mean, if you go back and you look at their communications and when they were establishing the government, they were bitter. They were horrible to each other. They fought. They called each other the worst things. They weren't on the same page. And yet we managed to get this country. That's because of the fighting, not despite it.
Yeah, no, I think I'm more afraid of winning for nothing than I am of losing. It is more dispiriting to win elections and to feel like the same battles are being joined in real life on the like day-to-day level against these. And I think it has a lot to do with institutional power, right? But it is more depressing to win and feel like nothing is changing in those battles than it is to simply lose. Maybe people don't share that with me, but like when we didn't take the Senate in the midterms, I was like, how does this change my life? The fact that Republicans do or don't control the Senate. It actually doesn't, because when Republicans control the Senate, they don't do the things that I care about. Like, yeah, maybe on the margins, some minor thing gets put into the omnibus that doesn't get put into the omnibus. On the actual day-to-day battles on both economic and cultural, the fact that, the Senate is one way or another by a few senators does not actually affect, and it doesn't affect my life because the people who ostensibly I'm voting for don't move the ball on the issues that I care about, right? They're not moving the ball on anything approaching reining in the administrative state. Right. Mm-hmm. They're not moving the ball on crime or immigration or a million other things that I think are actually incredibly important. By the way, that is one substantive issue I'd like to see. Like, if Cotton could be, could be party leader in the Senate, I would be very happy to see, because he's been fantastic on crime issues, even when, in my view, because I'm like, I've always been a 1994 crime bill. Tough on crime. And that was not a popular position in the Republican Party and on the right for a long time. But Cotton, I think, was right when he was criticizing the First Step Act. And anyway, it would be nice to have a real tough on crime.
When all that happened, I was still a raging liberal. And so I had totally different views on crime at the time. I mean, now, yeah, I think I'm with you now. But I mean, it is, you're right. The battle always is, and I don't think this is any different in any other sector of humanity, to be honest. The battle is always between those who are comfortable and those who are uncomfortable. And it is human nature. This is the brilliance of our founding documents, that they handed over the consequences of human nature to God instead of to the law. So, but it is human nature for us to seek comfort and then to sit on it. And it takes an extraordinary human being, or a human being that has access to the extraordinary, to battle that aspect of human nature. I believe that is why you see when movements get big, be it a church movement, be it a political movement or social movement, when movements get big, Black Lives Matter, Civil Rights Movement, Tea Party, you end up with a huge establishment class at the top. Once people realize they can make money off of their passions, then those passions bleed into or morph into comfort. And that is what we're battling always. We're battling the people who have made it to the top, who are in comfort and who don't want to risk that comfort. That is why you see so few leaders. It's why we need rich guys in office, really, because we need guys who aren't pursuing the comfort. They're already there and they don't need government for it. But that is why you see these men and women you think are great ideologues. We send them to DC and then they crumble. It's just really hard not to get absorbed by the pursuit of comfort. And I'm not sure that most of us have the ability not to be. I guess this is why I sound like I have a little bit of grace for the Mitch McConnells of the world. I don't know how many of us, when we got to the top, would be the people we started out as.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of entropy to it. And you're suggesting a physical kind of comfort and entropy, but there's an ideological one as well. I mean, it is really hard to be at odds with your environment.
True.
We are social creatures. And you know, you do have to reach out. You are having repeated interactions with these people with whom you disagree, right? And it's really hard to be disagreeable all the time to the people that you work with on a repeated basis. It really does require, I think what it requires is a really strong tether back to where you came from and your voters elected you, right?
Which is the government that our founding fathers designed, right?
You're right. I mean, like that.
That's even in
a representative democracy, right? You have that always like the assimilatory function of being in DC. And I mean, look, we've dealt with that for a long time. As you say, the founders discussed this problem. Everybody was sort of aware of this problem. I mean, it's a much larger problem with the permanent bureaucracy. Even at least you can say that Mitch McConnell has to stand for election every 6 years. That's not the case for a large percentage of people who've been working in government in the same bureau for 30 years. And they have opinions on how that small job is supposed to be conducted. And they're not amenable to having somebody like Donald Trump tell them, nope, actually we're doing it a totally different way after 30 years. This is a much, much bigger sort of establishment problem or assimilatory problem. But But yeah, I mean, like Jackson instituted rotation in office for that reason. We've had populist waves repeatedly in this country for that reason. There have been many periods in our history where people basically said, yeah, these people are detached. Like they're detached from the problems in the country and they're just all best friends with each other. Like immediately after the founding, the historical era is labeled the era of good feelings. What it actually was is a uniparty rule, right? Where you have the same people in Washington for 30 years. And there was a populist backlash against that, right? Even with, one could say, like higher caliber, we like to imagine, right? Higher caliber politicians and people who were more invested in this fledgling republic. But there was still that like entropic feel and pull of DC, just like while the founders were still alive, it had devolved into a swamp and required a populist cleansing and booting people out and bringing in new people. And those people then became eventually after 30 years, those people became like, there is something to what you're saying. There's just like this endless process of, you know what, like we need to make government not a permanent position.
That's why I used to work in nonprofit. They used to run the after school program. And that is one of the things that you learn pretty quickly in that job as director. You got to rotate out, because you start getting corporate, right? You start having to deal with the money people, go to the fundraisers, head to the Capitol, shake the hands of politicians, and it dulls you. And so any good nonprofit that's doing charitable work, at least, is switching leadership quite often for that very reason. So yeah, it makes sense. It's hard not to get sucked up. I mean, I pay a lot of attention to like church politics or politics in Christendom, as it were. And even there's a huge issue that's happening now in the evangelical movement with a lot of these mega church pastors. You get to the top, you rise, you're surrounded suddenly by so much income, so much adoration, so much publicity. It is the rare pastor who doesn't succumb to that. Even in a church environment, I guess even like the Catholic Church could say the same thing. People at the top, not necessarily honoring it. I guess lately what I'm saying in all of this is that I've been thinking so much about what human nature is and how we use our laws and our politics to try to wrestle human nature. And how that only brings more angst and more trouble, because we simply cannot do it. You cannot create laws to mold human nature. You can only create a government that works with human nature. I think we're the closest to that here in America. But all of this has got me thinking a lot lately, just about like how our government is supposed to serve human nature and in a way let loose human nature.
Yeah, I think I would say channel it, right? Like
that's better. Yeah, that's good.
Like this is a battle that can't ever be. So I'm very much a conservative in the soul constrained vision way, in that I do think human nature is unchanged, which is why remarkably when we read about civilizations 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago. People are recognizably human to us. It's that human quality that Shakespeare relies upon. It is this like thread of human nature, not necessarily lovely, by the way, that is constant throughout all of these different ways in which we've arranged society. But I mean, there is a sort of Sisyphean aspect to this, because we do have to fight and channel human nature. That is the nature of let's say something like virtue, like practicing virtue at all, is a battle with one's instincts, and people are capable of joining that battle, right? And so there is this balance between recognizing that the battle is good, that it's something that has to be continually fought, but also recognizing that you can't remake fundamentally human beings, and trying to design a system in which the the imperfect nature of man is going to be, I mean, it's always going to be a detriment to any kind of utopian vision, but to try to design a system in which it is accounted for, expected, accepted, and instead of I guess, utopian style repressed or taken away or transformed, channeled into a more productive society. And I agree with you that the founders set up the best system for doing that. I don't think we live in that system anymore for a variety of reasons. And this has been like the big transformation for me. And we've been talking about the Tea Party and into the Trump era. I think the Tea Party was a restorationist movement, and the Trump movement is not. And it has taken me quite a long time to be okay with that. I think accepting the death of the Republic has been difficult for me. I do, you know, my parents are immigrants. I really do believe in the founding principles of the United States and their execution through documents. And then also the like large unwritten tradition of the United States that goes along with the Constitution and the Declaration that has made this country exceptional. But I think it's really hard to look at the system. If you were an alien dropped into the United States today, and you were asked to write an essay like describing the political system of the United States, what you would come up with is something that is wholly, not to double use alien, but like wholly alien to the Republic the founders imagined. And not just in those imperfect ways, but like in its actual functioning, this is not the way that we live. 90% of decisions are made either through the courts or through administrative practice. The powers of the states are severely curtailed. There's no moral assertion at all in politics on the right.
And that's the problem. And that's the basis of all of this, right? I agree with you. Our republic is crumbling. And we certainly do not live with the form of government that our founding fathers intended and hoped. But they also warned us, right? They also told us that we can't keep this republic if we are not a moral people with a permanent moral compass, a true north enshrined right there in our founding documents. And so that's why I'm in politics. I'm not a political creature by nature, but I am a cultural creature. And I understand how politics and culture, or I seek to understand how politics and culture are so closely related. And our republic is capable. Our republic, it can be, could be what our founding fathers intended if we had not experienced this sharp cultural slide that we've seen over the last 100 years. We have the mechanisms to have that republic, to live in that republic that you've admired and I've admired and that we long to see in its whole vision. I forgot what I was saying. I lost my train of thought. I'm almost 50. So you guys have to give me a break here.
I'm 36 and that happens to me all the time.
But the point is that everything, the reason I ran for school board, right? The transgender stuff, the CRT stuff, corruption in, you know, the financing, all of that is connected to this moral decline that we've seen, the spiritual decline that we've seen. We simply do not have the moral or spiritual backbone to uphold a republic. And in that respect, I share your melancholy view of it. And I too have had to make some adjustments in how I think about how we're moving forward and what the future holds. We don't have the republic that we had even 100 years ago. And I don't know that unless we solve our moral dilemma, our spiritual dilemma, that we'll be able to get back to that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is where, despite how sort of apocalyptic and depressing politics, like partisan politics is and has been in the last 6 years or so, I actually get more depressed. And we're going to turn to some cultural issues now, because I don't see that ability increasingly when I look at, and you know this very well, like the education that we're providing. When I look at the very basic, you know, Mary Ebersat wrote a great book about this called Primal Screams, but, and she's been on this pod. So if you haven't either read the book or listened to that episode, you should go back. But, you know, that don't have even the kind of basic stability and anti-fragility to engage in self-government. I don't see that because we have now, at minimum, two generations, maybe three, that have grown up post 1960s cultural revolutions and who are deprived. I mean, America is one of the countries in the world with the highest percentage of children who do not grow up until age 18 under the same roof with their married biological parents, whether that's, you know, single motherhood and never married, whether it's divorce, whether it's, you know, a variety of different arrangements, sort of blended families, whatever, like the percentage of kids who get that kind of nuclear family stability growing up is smaller and smaller. You combine that with some of the assault, and I'm in the middle of Abigail Schreier's new book, Bad Therapy, a kind of assault on competency and resilience from a therapeutic perspective that purports to sort of replace the confidence of actually doing things and, you know, accomplishing tasks and succeeding things and the kind of self-confidence that can instill in a child with a kind of like pride and fragility and inability to deal with life. I look at all this stuff and I think like how, when the median kid, gets the kind of quote unquote education, that we provide in our public schools, which is not only incredibly ideologically biased, but doesn't provide a strong basis in reading, writing, and arithmetic. Right. And most importantly in history and, in civics of this country, doesn't have a stable home life. Is the, you know, child of never married or parents divorcing before they hit 18 and are launched into the world. Forgetting about everything else in politics. I don't understand how that brew creates people who are capable of self-government.
It doesn't. That's why we've seen an attack on those systems from, well, decades and decades, but really at least since after the war, after World War II. But that is why I know there are way too many Republicans even, and even many conservatives who are low, and especially in the church even, who loathe the cultural battles. But that is exactly what the cultural battle is. It's not a battle to see who can be in charge and who can be the most prudish. It's a battle to create a base that we can build a republic on. That's exactly what our founding fathers told us. That's exactly what they told us about the moral value of belief in a higher God, in a higher creator, in a creator. But yeah, of course. And that's the whole point. Why do you think Black Lives Matter, before they got in trouble for it and removed it, why do you think they had on their website, one of our goals is to disrupt the nuclear family, to take the patriarch out of the family? That's a stated Marxist goal. Why? Because that is how you break down solid voters. That's how you break down people who are involved in their government and who care about what happens in their own community. If you don't grow up in a home where people cared about you, they didn't even care enough about you to keep your family intact or to keep you fed, or to keep you away from drug dealers or whatever, to keep you away from abuse. You have that, then you grow up in a neighborhood that is uncaring. Everybody just watching out for themselves. Everybody just making sure their own house is okay. What kind of citizen do you become? Of course you become a citizen who doesn't care about the people around them, because you have not even had the base, that basic understanding. We moved here to, I live in Orange County, California now. I live in a cozy little middle-class suburb, but we came from Gary, Indiana. We came from the hood. That's where my husband lived and was born and raised. That's where I moved when we got married. And that's where we had our family. And, but at some point we had to look around and we had to say, what are we modeling for this family? We're together, we're middle class, but we're in an area where there's, you know, I live directly across the street from our public elementary school and I drive my kids to private school every day because we can't go there. We high crime, low law enforcement, all of that. Well, we moved here to Orange County, totally different situation. Everybody's married. Everybody's in a family. Mom and dad are at soccer practice. I can't get into a classroom to volunteer. Back in Gary, if you had two parents, if you lived in a home with two parents, those were the two parents that were in the classroom every time because they were the only people available to do it. Here, you can't get into a classroom because, you know, it's cutthroat, girl, trying to get a volunteer spot in a kindergarten class here in Orange County. Every mom wants to do it. And my husband and I were just talking the other day and we were like, forget about all the holes we've left in our parenting. Because as your kids get older, you start to realize, oh, shoot, all the ways you failed. Forget about that. Just being here has set them up for a type of success that they wouldn't have had we stayed in Gary, because they're seeing marriage and nuclear family modeled everywhere they look. It's what's normal to them. That matters. And those communities are few. If you can hear the noise, there's a street sweeper out there. But those communities are fewer and farther between, and that is on purpose. And any conservative and any Republican who says we should stay away from the cultural battles, stay away from the social issues, and just focus on the politics is an idiot. They don't understand how these things are intimately connected, and that is why the left goes after children, not Mitch McConnell's.
On that note, I wanted to ask you, you've been involved in, especially since, as you say, you pay a lot of attention to sort of interchurch politics. It's a very foreign topic to me. but I wanted to ask about, like, so there's been some kerfuffle even on the right about the trad wives and that, like, sort of rising internet sensation of women. And I've talked about it a little bit before on the podcast with Emily Jashinsky, and I wrote a piece about it for The Spectator. But so I have my views, but I'm wondering what your view is on this kind of online phenomenon, because it seems like from what you're saying that we are increasingly living in a society where a lot of kids won't have what your kids have, which is not only that kind of normalcy modeled for them at home, but like modeled around them in the community in which they live, where it's not just that mom and dad, and actually there's been some great social research on this that I don't have off the top of my head, but recall reading, which is that actually like the impact of divorce later in life on children is mitigated by how many or of the father leaving the family, you know, before marriage or whatever is actually amplified if that situation is happening everywhere in the community. In other words, where you have, like, as is the situation, and as Moynihan pointed out many years ago already, as is the situation in a lot of Black communities in this country, but is like increasingly the situation with everybody else other than Asians. Like, not just the fact that the nuclear family has broken in a particular child's case, but that the concept of fatherhood is culturally disappearing. In other words, not just the broken home for the child himself, but 8 out of 10 families on the block are broken. And so that entire concept of even that there's a loss that the father isn't there, for example,
right,
is gone. Like, so you would think that in this world where increasingly what you and I would call normalcy with regard to the family is not normal, and fewer kids have that model, you would think that having like this kind of online like avatar of a traditional home could be a positive. No, but I feel like you're a little ambivalent about it, or at least from the tweets that I've seen.
I'm really just an observer on this side. The whole trad wife thing makes me feel so old. I'm Gen X. And I'm like, why do you kids have to shorten everything? Why do you gotta take letters out of everything? They're not traditional wives. They're trad wives. So I do feel like get off my lawn about it all. But I'll say this. It's good and bad to me. What I find it to be is fascinating, because what I think it is a correction. It's a reaction and an overcorrection. And it tells us what, in a way, it tells us what our society is desperate for, desperately needing. This is why we're seeing the rise of guys like Andrew Tate on the right. Now, if you listen to Andrew Tate, sometimes he says stuff that is just like, what? Somebody needs to put a foot in your mouth and shove it all the way down your throat. Like, he is a complete bore, for lack of a better term. You know, he's a pig. But sometimes he says stuff and you're like, yep, he's absolutely right about that. It's masculinity, manhood, leadership, what, you know, being honest maybe about what men and women want. Well, why is that guy? He's so bombastic. He's so rude and he's so full of himself. But why is that guy so popular? Because he is exuding something that is desperately missing for males in American society, which is masculinity. And so to go back to our conversation about human nature, well, the tale of human history tells us we overcorrect always. We never do it any other way. History is just a push and pull of overcorrections. And this is an overcorrection, but it's in response to something that's very real. And that's how I feel about the trad wives things. These women are influencers. Okay, so let's not get it twisted. They're chicks who get on TikTok or whatever, and they're trolling for your clicks. So, and that is the name of their game. They're influencers. That word has meaning. But outside of that, the reason they're so influential is because they're modeling something. They're at least presenting a shadow of something that most women, I believe, in America are desperate for. Femininity, motherhood, wifehood, traditional family structure. We are only ever told these days to be a girl boss. We're never ever told that you can stay home and make dinner for your family and be there for your children when they get off school. And not only that, but that it's fulfilling, that it feels good. And I think when people are, particularly women, are looking at these trad wives and responding with adoration, what they're responding to is this permission to say, hey, yeah, I have these motherly, wifely instincts. I have these instincts that tell me I do want to be a stay-at-home mom, or I do want to quit my job when I have a family and work from the home. And the trad wife is giving women that permission where we have not been able to voice that, because when we voice it, we're shattered down, or we're told we're tools of the patriarchy, we're not real women. And that has had such a detrimental effect. I was raised by a hippie. My mom's a baby boomer. I was raised without a father for most of my life. And I was raised in an atheist household. So we didn't really have any traditional values. And I was raised to believe, like, you go out there, you have your career, you get all your success first, do all the things you want to do in life, and then settle down, because, you know, then your family is the worst thing that ever happened. And so you want to get all the fun stuff out of the way first, so you can have not fun with your family. I can't tell you how shocked I was to discover, after becoming a mother, how fulfilled I was by getting dinner on the table at night. I hate to cook. I still do. I'm not good at it. But there is something to be said for making a home for your family. And we do not glorify that anymore, or even recommend it anymore. So that's what I see about the trad wife craze. I do believe it's an overcorrection, and people are making it a costume instead of a value. But I understand why, and I see the same thing happening with the Andrew Tates of the world. That's happening. This whole inclusivity and breaking down of genders and gender fluid thing has only created toxic masculinity and toxic femininity. But that's a response to people who are absolutely starving for masculinity and femininity modeled as it's meant to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's so important to have, I think, even in this very fake way, I do think it's better than not having it, right? So that's really the conclusion of my piece is on this subject is there's much to hate about any influencer niche. I feel like it's obviously, but we kind of know it's a con, right? Like nobody is scrolling, at least nobody over the age of, you know, 13. I understand like with young girls, it's different and they really do believe apparently in a lot of like, I feel like anybody of a certain age, we know when we're scrolling a feed of Instagram or whatever it is, or TikTok, like we know that a lot of that is fake. It's created for the camera, right? And that applies equally to the trad wives as it does to every other niche of influencer. And there is this kind of fakeness of social media. But I think it's really important to put out the notion at all, like as an archetype, that because even though, you know, the right has been saying for a long time, it's okay women to not be as ambitious in your career, to like, as you say, to like be fulfilled by putting food on the table for your family, like cooking a beautiful meal and keeping a house and taking care of your children. Like conservatives always said, that's okay. That's important. But those are words. And if you look at what people do, what like archetypes they look up to, what they want their daughters to be, right? What Hollywood stories they tell their kids, right? I feel like a lot of our current culture is very much not only against that, but against even imagining it as a possibility that is good and fulfilling and glamorous. And so, yeah, like some of that glamour is fake. Of course it is. Like you're not seeing, they're not filming themselves like scrubbing vomit off the floor, right? Yes. They're doing like a very aesthetic little cake in like several different colors. And
I think that's what some women resent about it too.
Right. And I understand that resentment, but I guess my question back has been, well, do you just resent all social media? Because it's obvious. Right. I mean, none of us are showing like, I don't know, day three of the flu. Like, you know,
yeah,
like, right. Actually some younger people do that. And that's kind of bad in its own way. But like,
yes, we can have a whole different conversation about oversharing.
Right. Exactly. But like, we know that social media is presenting in some ways false, like the most beautiful parts of our lives. Right. And then if you are a glamorous, beautiful woman, like somebody like Hannah Nealman, Ballerina Farms, or that like new one, what's her name? That the model who's married to another model.
I don't know. Boobs McGee.
Who makes Oreos from scratch. Like,
yeah.
Does the Oreo knockoffs from scratch or whatever. Like these are glamorous people. And no matter what they did, they would be beautiful and glamorous, right? Like
these are people that put on makeup to go to the gym.
Right. Like they could be filming themselves on yachts in Capri, right? And nobody would see saying anything, but the fact that they're applying their natural glamour to this role seems to set people off more than like, I don't hear people complaining about the Instagram girls in, St. Bart's when everybody is cold in the winter.
You know what,
like,
I think it is? Unattainable. You know what I think it is? I read an interesting, using the term loosely, interesting article in The Root a year or two ago about the upper class snobbery of stay-at-home moms and how having a lot of children and staying at home has become a new status symbol. And although the article was, you know, typically progressive and The Root is ultra progressive, they had some good points. They made some good points. And one of the things that I found interesting was this concept of, yeah, it used to be the working class was for your big family. If you had a big family, you were working class. And there are lots of different reasons for that. But obviously that rooted in back in the day when you needed a lot of kids to work the farm, work the family businesses, the more kids, the better for your family. Now, working class people have to work. You know, mom's got to go to work. That's childcare. How many kids can they afford? How much childcare can they afford? And they're on this hamster wheel, childcare, work, childcare to pay for work, pay for childcare. Who has the resources to have big families and stay at home and buy fancy phones to record all of their stuff? That's wealthy people. That's upper class and middle class. So the family, the idea of having a family and a large family has really become a middle class and upper class ideal and pursuit in a lot of ways. And I guess that kind of goes back to exactly what you were saying earlier about how we don't see these things modeled. I certainly, in Gary, absolutely not. We were the model and we were just barely married when we lived there. We were the model because we were the only people we knew under the age of 50 who were married. And there were no two-parent homes. There were none. Here, it's so common, it's actually odd to see. I mean, even if it's step families, if people are married, but this is middle class. It's modeled here. It's modeled as normal. But when we were working class or living in a working class community, something else was modeled. And that is what is perpetuated. So I think when the whole tradwives discussion is also bound up in a discussion of class and resources. And of course, now I would like to add this caveat as a mother of over 21 years, you can't put a price on your kids. Kids don't make you poor. Other things make you poor, kids don't make you poor. So if you're poor, have lots of kids, as long as you can take care of them. The more kids, the better. Have lots of kids, no matter where you are. That being said, I do think that this does boil down for a lot of people, especially women, because, you know, we're very aspirational. It boils down to jealousy in a lot of ways. A lot of people feel like that lifestyle is for middle class.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have a sense that, you know, it's a very weird feeling to think that, like, actually, in some ways, people, you know, 500 years ago might have been richer. And I'm not like that kind of trad that I think like life was always better in the past, but I don't think actually overall life was better as a medieval peasant, but that like actually nobody would consider it a luxury to have a stable home life and have, you know, a large family and lots of siblings. Of course, a lot of people died before the age of 5, but in that sense, right, there's this very weird thing where the basics of humanity in many ways are a luxury or being sold as a luxury product. And I do think that does engender some backlash, but I think it feels out of reach both culturally and economically for a lot of people, right? Economically for the reasons we just discussed, culturally because a lot of people don't come from that background. Whether it's just about family stability or even about family size, I mean, the idea of having like a lot of brothers and sisters, that's rarer and rarer, right? So when you look at a family like Hannah Neilman's, I think they have 8 kids or something like that, right? And a married family and a wife who stays home and is able to take care of like the house and the children, like this doesn't look like something that's attainable to people at all. In fact, what we're seeing is the drop-off of dating, the drop-off of you know, even of sex, right? So this just feels like cruel, I think, to a lot of people. It feels like a cruel ideal that is easy because of their own background to say is fake.
But and the irony is
faker than anything else on social media.
Well, and the irony is that these traditional values are what will get you to that status, right? To that class. Because there are certain things that are statistical permanence. If you graduate high school, if you wait until you're married to have children, and then when you get married, you stay married, you're like almost guaranteed to not live in poverty. So, that seems so unattainable. And of course, then we have the social media glam of it all that makes it look unattainable. But the basic notion of a nuclear family might feel unattainable. That's on purpose. When really that's actually the way to that middle and upper class. And every statistic bears it out through as long as we've been taking statistics. That's why I always hate this. We have a little bit of a, I'm giving you some inside baseball in here. Okay. In the Black conservative community, we have a bit of a, conflict over the statistics that we all use as conservatives about Black households. 73% of children are born into single parent households. there's a faction of Black conservatives who feel like that statistic gets thrown around, but it's not really dug into. And just because kids are born 73% to single parent households doesn't mean they don't have a father in their lives. Just means the father's not in the home. And so they feel that that's unfair. I happen to be on the realist side of things. And I think that, yes, it does matter if 73% of Black children are born to single parent households, even if dad is in the picture, because marriage matters, because that mom and that dad living in the same house matters. It changes the trajectory of your child. If your child is born into a home where you and your wife live together, or you and your baby mama live separately, it changes the trajectory of your child. And in order for your child to get off that statistical trajectory, it takes a lot of other community and spiritual influences. And we don't wrestle enough with the idea of marriage and family being the key to living successfully, to living aspirationally, to breaking into that middle class. We don't talk about that enough. We certainly don't talk about it in the Black community enough, but in America at large, absolutely not. And so at the very least, I'm with you, this trad wife thing, and even the Andrew Tates of the world, at least we're talking about this. At least we're talking about the values of traditional marriage and nuclear family. But I'm dismayed at how many conservatives have bought the lie that your kid raised outside of the traditional family structure is just going to have all the same advantages and all the, it's the same thing. If you've got two gay parents, it's the same thing as having a mom and a dad in the home. It's absolutely not. And all of it trickles up straight to the White House.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're increasingly in a world where making those arguments is harder because you're bumping up against, I think, very understandable psychological defensiveness from people, because the fewer people are raised in that model, the harder it becomes to set it out as an ideal without sounding judgmental, critical of the way that either you have lived your life or your parents lived their lives, right? And I do think, like, I'm not much on the, oh, I feel like we always rely on, oh, we have bad messaging when we lose, like, never. I think it's kind of a cop-out a lot of times, but I do think this is something that we need to take seriously on the right, is how to talk about some of these family issues when you know statistically, the people that you're talking to are not going to have that reflected in their own lives, and even might be, already on the third generation of having it, or fourth generation of it not reflected in their family lives. And nobody wants to sit around and like listen to somebody call their mom a bad mom, right? Like, and that's not what we're saying, right? But it is like really difficult. It will be increasingly difficult to talk about these issues. But I think you're right. Like, they are in some ways the most important issues for us to talk about. And so it's the difficulty is not an excuse for not doing it.
Yeah, I agree. The difficulty and the ostracization, you get it. But I know that there are a lot of people who feel like they're going to be put outside their circles, for maybe being bold. Like, I'll give you an example. I was talking to a family member of mine last night. She's 34 years old and she's still trying to find herself. And she has a potential marriage partner. This is a relationship that could go somewhere, but she's, I don't know. I want to do this first. I want to do that next. And I was like, well, do you want to have a family? And she said, yeah, I want to have four kids. And I was like, well, you're 34, so you don't have the time to wait. And you're actually already past your prime to find a good mate who's going to grow with you. So if this guy's a good guy and he wants to be with you and you guys love each other and have a respect for the institution, I don't know what you're waiting for, because you're going to wait yourself right out of this family that you want. It is costly to say that out loud, because I did hurt her feelings, because people hear out of their hurt, right? I think we all innately know the things that are wrong with us. And when someone, says something that holds up that mirror, it can create defensiveness. She didn't like to hear it, but later on she said, wow, no other woman has spoken to me like this. no other woman has told me this. She's like, I guess I should learn that I shouldn't ask you questions I don't want to know the answer to. I'm like, yeah, but there is this, there's a desperate need, I think, for women to be very honest with each other. And because we're just, we've been sold this thing, this girl power thing, along with it comes like, ah, women all support each other. But that's just so surface level. Like, we got to be able to be honest with each other. And those of us who are older and are, you know, over that hump of early life and early momhood, it is incumbent upon us to speak graciously, but clearly to younger women and younger couples, and to be bold. I never meet a younger couple who's telling me they have intentions on getting married without telling them you don't have all the time in the world. If you want to get married, do it sooner rather than later. I tell my daughter, if you find a good partner, get married sooner rather than later. Yeah, if you find a good partner in college and you want to get married in college, you do that. But this idea that we have are setting forth for, even we do this again, even as you said, people are now 2-3 generations into this, so it seems normal. Even in the conservative movement, we normalize some of this stuff. I wrote an article and I did a podcast on cohabitation. I know it's not a popular subject because everybody lives together before they get married nowadays. Almost everybody does. Did you?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. I did. That is a hard topic to discuss, cohabitation and how it actually lowers the opportunity for marriage, statistically speaking, and how it actually raises the age that women will have children or give birth. That's something that affects the future family too, but that's something that's never talked about these days, ever. Parents don't sit and talk to their kids about what does it mean to live with somebody before you're married to them? What does marriage mean? What are your goals? Like, all of these are discussions that maybe part of that is because we just don't have the dinner table anymore, you know, to hash these things out and argue back and forth. But I did an episode on cohabitation. I did it for my kids because I was like, I don't know if we've ever sat down and discussed this. We just all kind of think this is the next step. This is the normal thing. But there's a whole other conversation about what it means for family and marriage moving forward. And there are difficult conversations that we need to be having on the right, culturally speaking, that are like this. Yeah, I've seen that IVF discussion popping up on Twitter. Me and you have gone back and forth on Twitter, on X about it. But it is a valuable discussion to be had for conservatives. Surrogacy, adoption, gay marriage, all of that stuff has real world consequences. We don't talk about them anymore because we've convinced ourselves that we're not allowed to talk about the social issues. We should just unify around the political issues because the social issues are so sticky and icky. But as we started out this podcast by talking about how we need our reps in government to get into the sticky and icky. We need it. We need to do the same thing culturally. We need to hash these ideas. Even if we don't come to agreements, we disagree, whatever. The fact that we're not even talking about them grieves me. And when we don't give those ideas the light of day, that's when you get the trad wives, the Andrew Tates. That's when you get those overcorrections, these people who get to build up these platforms in the dark because we've pushed those ideas to the fringes. And then by the time it gets so big that it's spilling out into mainstream, we're like, where did these people come from? We're making these people because we're not having these conversations out and open in the public anymore.
Couldn't agree with you more. Keira Davis, where can people find more of Keira Davis?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Real Keira Davis and go by my book, Drawing Lines, Why Conservatives Need to Begin to Battle Fiercely in the Arena of Ideas, and join my Substack. It's just keiradavis.substack.com. And then, of course, my podcast is Just Listen to Yourself. And you heard me talk a little bit about that, but on that podcast, it's a critical thinking podcast. I just pick a topic and I just reason through it. And the whole idea is to get people to think about what they believe, think through your ideas, think through arguments, and whether or not we come to the same conclusion at the end of an episode is neither here nor there. The important thing is that you know what you believe so you can defend it.
Well, thank you for coming on and so ably defending what you believe on High Noon, Keira.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
And thank you to our listeners. High Noon with Inez Stepman is a production of the Independent Women's Forum. As always, you can send comments and questions to inez.stepman@iwf.org. Please help us out by hitting the subscribe button and leaving us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts, Acast, Google Play, YouTube, or iwf.org. Be brave, and we'll see you next time on High Noon.